Our next panel concerns development and education. And the chair of the panel is a lady who is no stranger to the National Council and to the Middle East, Mrs. Harriet Fulbright. She serves as president of the J. William and Harriet Fulbright Center, a nonprofit organization which serves to continue Mrs. Fulbright's life's work in global education and to advance the work of her husband, former longtime U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman and National Council on U.S. Arab Relations National Advisory Board Chairman, Senator J. William Fulbright. Mrs. Fulbright?
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to address the topic of education and development before this very distinguished audience. And after some thought about this, I thought I would like to take the excellent lead of John Duke Anthony and begin with the what, when, why, and how questions regarding education, because its many facets and many purposes can impact us at every age. First, what is it? In the age of Thomas Jefferson, education was a body of knowledge that every well-born citizen was expected to acquire. Nowadays, however, the information available and the knowledge imparted to students today, it is vast. In fact, the whole of Jefferson's library is much smaller than the website of the last Olympic Games. Furthermore, the educators of today are faced with classrooms of children much more challenging than those 250 years ago. In Arlington, Virginia, where I live, for instance, it is not unusual to face a group of students with more than 40 different first languages, and that means 40 different cultures, 40 different ways of looking at the world, and ways of creating community. That's a real challenge for a teacher. When education begins is equally different than it was in the past. Back then, it started about the age of 5 or 6, and depending on the family station, it ended either in the 6th or the 12th grade, with only a few privileged going to university, and none of it for African Americans. These days, parents start teaching their infants, and a decade ago, my father went back to college at the age of 85. He ended up both attending classes and teaching. The answer to why is so obvious I won't dwell on it, except to ask you just what kind of life you think you would be living without it. I don't even want to contemplate that answer. But all this is the buildup for really the crucial question, how? With the relentless expansion of factual information, the memorization of much beyond the basics of language, mathematics, geography, and major subjects, and the field of one's choice, that becomes very difficult. And the ability to analyze data critically and to think creatively, that becomes essential. In fact, this realization has been with us for quite a while. Over 150 years ago, there was a growing awareness that the mere accumulation of information does not automatically create an educated person. Henry Adams long ago put it most forcefully in his Education of Henry Adams when he wrote that nothing in education is so astonishing as the amount of ignorance it accumulates in the form of inert facts. Good education, educational institutions the world over realize that students need to learn how to use facts to analyze problems, how to question situations in order to make improvements, how to dream up answers to the question, what if? They must also learn how to work collaboratively instead of always competing. More and more students are also encouraged to become aware of the needs of their communities and to lend a hand after school, whether in a home for the elderly or a cleanup campaign in a public park. In other words, education is becoming more of a training ground for good citizenship, for helping the community constantly improve itself, and for continual development lifelong. If education is to serve a country and satisfy the needs of all its citizens, it must fulfill its mission in all its aspects, the technical and the intellectual, the practical and the ethical, the social and the individual. When Senator Fulbright stated, as he so often did, that democracy can only flourish under a thoughtful, responsible, and educated citizenry, he was not referring to the stuffing of students with information and statistics that they can spit back during multiple choice tests. He was talking about teaching through all of our intelligences so that lifelong learning becomes a universal habit, about honing higher critical thinking skills with which to analyze and evaluate both professional problems and government policy to become better voters as well as more successful in a career, about the encouragement of creative thought to produce, to focus on, and find solutions for such massive problems as environmental pollution, global economic policy, and about leading our young into active participation in a community so that it becomes a natural activity during adulthood. The type of education that makes the development in any country a continual and permanent aspect of life and makes what Senator Fulbright fervently believed an achievable reality. Toward the end of his life, he wrote, "Our future is not in the stars, but in our own minds and hearts. Creative leadership and liberal education, which in fact go together, are the first requirements for a hopeful future for mankind. Fostering these, leadership, learning, and empathy between cultures was and remains the purpose of the International Scholarship Program that I was privileged to sponsor in the U.S. Senate. It is a modest program with an immodest aim, the achievement in international affairs of a regime more civilized, rational, and humane than the empty system of power of the past. I believed in that possibility when I began, and I still do." We have a wonderful panel now, which is going to speak of education in specific terms in the area. And I would like to introduce each of them as they speak. Our first speaker is Admiral Theodore H. Katouf, President and Chief Executive Officer of AMETEAST. AMETEAST, American and Training Service, former ambassador to the United Arab Emirates and ambassador to Syria. He was a career Foreign Service officer serving as Deputy Chief of Mission in Damascus, Syria, and Riyadh, and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and eminently well qualified to address this subject. Ambassador Katouf.
He's going to speak from his
okay.
time.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fulbright. It's truly an honor to be on your panel, as this year is Amity's 40th year of administering the Fulbright Foreign Student Program in the Middle East and North Africa on behalf of the State Department. And when I try to explain to people what my organization does, I generally lead with the Fulbright program because, A, it's very well known, and B, anyone who knows anything about it knows how effective and important it has been in bringing scholars from all over the world to this country and having our scholars go abroad. This program has more than lived up to your late husband's vision of a program that will bring a little more knowledge, a little more reason, and a little more compassion into world affairs, and thereby increases the chances that nations will learn at last to live in peace and in friendship. Indeed, like many, I believe it is the preeminent scholarship and public diplomacy program in this or any other country. Currently, at Amity East, we have been responsible for placing, helping to select, place, and look after 270 students from the Middle East and North Africa who are currently studying in the United States. They come from 15 countries spanning the region, including Algeria, Bahrain, Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Libya, Morocco, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Tunisia, the U.S., the UAE, the West Bank, Gaza, and Yemen. But it's obviously it's a good way to help get young Iraqis reconnected to the United States, even though the Iraqis and Libyans reconnected to the United States, even though both countries have robust scholarship programs of their own that they fund. I personally have met many of these Fulbright scholars during my 6 years at Amity East, and I've been tremendously impressed by their qualifications, their leadership, their commitment to their disciplines, and their desire to return and help better their own societies, as well as their commitment to the Fulbright vision of improved understanding. Dr. Abdulrahman Al-Sayed is going to be commenting, but it is my personal belief that because so many Saudis, for instance, studied in this country who are now in important positions, whether in the government, in the leadership, in the military, in the business community, that when 9/11 happened, it was like a shock absorber, I think, in that there was a large group of Saudis who understood this country well, understood why it reacted as it did, and it was important, you know, it was very important. And indeed, in a number of countries in the MENA region, you have cabinets full of people who have gotten their education in the U.S. or the U.K. at some point. It might have been an undergraduate degree, a graduate degree, postdoctoral work. But we should not underrate the importance of having so many people come and study in our country. Today, as the head of an organization that administers nearly 24 exchange programs, I am pleased to note that we have a new advocate for educational exchange, and he has a quite bully pulpit in the White House. Not only does President Barack Obama value the improved cross-cultural understanding that comes from such activities, he espouses it as a way of strengthening our ties in the Arab and Muslim world. The President pledged during his speech to students at Cairo University that was seen and listened to all over the world and certainly all over the Islamic world. He pledged to expand exchange programs and increase scholarships like the one that brought, as he said, my father to America. As he further noted, quote, simple exchanges can break down walls between us, for when people come together and speak to one another and share a common experience, then their common humanity is revealed. He made that pledge during a time of optimism in the Arab world that U.S. policy toward the region would change for the better. Gallup polls taken around that time recorded double-digit increases in approval from the last in comparison with the last measurements taken during the ending days of the Bush administration. These upsurges, which ranged from 11 percentage points in Syria to 23 points in Tunisia, may reflect a positive reception to Obama and his administration's public outreach to the Muslim world. But the president's decision to pull U.S. troops out of Iraq and to close Guantanamo Bay's prison are two actions that resonated among respondents in previous Gallup surveys and could help improve the United States' image as well. But the polls also revealed that approval ratings for the U.S. itself are still low in some quarters. The median approval of U.S. leadership was, for instance, very low in the Palestinian territories. Others appeared to be reserving their judgment in such countries as Saudi Arabia, Syria, Tunisia, and Lebanon, where this percentage of respondents answering don't know or people who refuse to answer altogether increased at least twofold over previous polling during the last days of the previous administration. Polls and other indicators tell us that a sustainable public diplomacy effort will be required to try to win the hearts and minds of people around the world. To me, it is very heartening that there actually is quite robust funding for public diplomacy initiatives, including exchange programs and the development of information technology that can help us communicate with others all over the world. And this just did not begin recently. During the Bush administration, funding was significantly increased, and there were several new public diplomacy initiatives taken that were largely aimed at the Arab Islamic region. And just to mention a few, there's the Youth Exchange and Study Program, better known as the YES Program. This was created by Congress shortly after 9/11, largely to the efforts of the late Senator Kennedy and Senator Lugar, who have continued right through to be patrons of this program. It brings high school-age girls and boys from countries with significant Muslim populations to the United States for an academic year of living with American families, attending school, and experiencing high school life and life in general in this country. Since its creation, several thousand youths have participated. And I must say that I was pleasantly surprised, being the cynic I am, as to how well it's all gone. You know, I thought clash of cultures, et cetera. It's a little, one thing I learned, I hope nobody takes offense, but one thing I learned is often the people who will take in these young people from foreign cultures often tend to be very conservative in their values, often Republican and the like. And of course, you have kids from the Islamic world who grew up in a conservative society. Maybe that's why it works, because different religions, but I think the students learn about the kinds of values that people in the heartland of America hold. And these young people then go back. They've been forming alumni associations in their countries. They're engaging in community activities, something that is often not all that encouraged in many countries in that part of the world. And they're beginning to give youth a positive voice. Short-term exchange opportunities are also important. Almost 100 women, young professional women, lawyers, businesswomen, women in finance, have participated in the Legal and Business Fellowship Program, again funded by the U.S. State Department, the State Department's Middle East Partnership Initiative. And these women, over the last several years, have come, spent a month at either the doing executive studies at the University of Pennsylvania, a cooperative program between the law school and the Wharton School of Business. They love that month there. I know that from having talked to so many of them over the last 3 years. And then they go out to several cities across the United States and are placed with top-tier law firms, financial firms, accounting organizations, and corporations. And they work for 4 months interning at those companies, learning how American business is done, then are brought back here for debriefings and activities in Washington before returning to their home countries. Again, they form alumni associations, not just, and they're not the only ones, there are alumni associations that they belong to that include young professionals who've participated in other programs in this country as well. And the State Department's been funding region-wide gatherings to help them network, to help them reinforce and contribute to one another's professional growth, and and if they're trying to be innovative and trying to do things a different way, making them feel that they're not alone. One other program that I'm particularly fond of that Amity's administers is the English Language Micro Scholarship Program, funded by the United States. I think we may underrate how important English language teaching is at a good level. It opens so many windows for youth. On the internet, I think in Arabic, if I understood correctly at a recent forum I attended in Jordan, only about 9% of the content of the internet can be accessed in Arabic. So you can imagine when you teach somebody fluent English, you open up a whole new world of knowledge, information, ways of thinking to them. It's tremendously important. And the State Department has been funding thousands of scholarships for young people, 14 to 18, from underserved communities. These are not elites. These are kids. It would be are their equivalent of the inner cities and the like, although often it's rural areas as well. And it's a good pool of young people. They also participate in community activities. They do summer work in English. And it provides a recruiting pool for the YES program, for instance. So you're teaching kids English. Of course, to go to a U.S. high school, you have to have fluent English. And we can get some of the best and the brightest of these youths from disadvantaged backgrounds coming here. And then those who have gone to high school here, and almost most of them do incredibly well. And when U.S. universities see their level of English and that they've already proven themselves at a U.S. high school, so they have some, so they actually can compare their grades with grades of U.S. students. Some of these kids are winning full scholarships to some of the best schools in this country, because the only schools that give need-blind scholarships are the MITs, the Harvards, and the Stanfords that have robust endowments even after the financial crisis. So I'm just going to end with a quote, because there are too many others who have much more to say and much better than I. But I'm going to quote a Syrian woman who was in the Fulbright program, and here's what she had to say. I'm enthusiastic about going back. I really hope it will improve relations. It's totally different from the previous one, so I think this will lead to an improvement in relations. Forget about government to government. It's the people that really matter. It's not like each Syrian is a terrorist or each American is unethical. It's about communicating on the things they agree upon. Both countries really love their families and appreciate family life. They may have different concepts of family life, but I think they all appreciate it. The most important objective for everyone here, is just living a decent life, going to work, raising children. I think when I go back, I will try to stress those common aspects to my countrymen, since there are stereotypes on both sides. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Juan Cole, who is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan and has written a number of works engaging the Muslim world, Napoleon's Egypt, Sacred Space and Holy War, Politics, Culture, and History of the Shia Islam. He is also president of Global Americana Institute. Dr. Cole.
Thank you very much. And it's a special honor for me to be on this panel. I had two Fulbright Awards in my career, and they were very important in my intellectual formation. I want to talk today a little bit about the challenges facing Iraqi higher education. And I know in Washington there's this odd conviction that the U.S. has been good for Iraq and transformed it into a beacon on the hill, and there's been a lot of allegations about the meaning of the U.S. invasion. But as someone who is an Arabist, lived in the Arab world, reads the Iraqi newspapers every day, I see a different reality there. I've also done field work with Iraqi refugees and refugee organizations in Jordan. That there are on the order of 1.3 million Iraqis displaced abroad as we speak, 2.5 million or so displaced internally, is often off the radar in this country. The ones in Jordan and Syria are disproportionately middle class, often have higher degrees, but their children are facing difficulties in schooling. Jordan has now opened the doors of its institutions to Iraqi school children, but there is a lost generation of children that were not able to get into school, and in Syria their situation is much worse. And inside the country, the universities have faced enormous difficulties. Of course, they have been caught up in the same security dilemmas as everybody else. Iraq had been among the more advanced Arab countries in the 60s, 70s. Its university system was early and distinguished. Other Arab students went to Iraq to study. Baghdad University, Basra University were advanced in many ways, and that produced a country with many professionals, including professional women. Iraqi women made great strides, and perhaps greater strides than any other Arab women than the Tunisian women in the 60s and 70s and 80s. The Iran-Iraq War, the Gulf War, and then the United Nations and United States sanctions on Iraq of the 1990s all contributed to a decline in the level of education and in the functioning of institutions such as universities, which was exacerbated by the 2003 American invasion and its aftermath, a series of bloody power struggles among contending parties and guerrilla groups. Iraqis had been among the more literate populations in the Arab world, and it's the only population that we know of that's gone backward in that regard. Literacy has actually fallen to 76% from higher levels earlier. In the late 20th century. In the period 2004 to 2008, the Iraqi Ministry of Education says that 263 university professors have been assassinated, 21 judges, 95 lawyers, 269 journalists were killed in that period. And of course, these numbers are low. The actual number is higher. This is from passive information gathering. In the wake of the U.S. invasion in 2003, Baghdad Medical College Library was looted, and 8,000 of its most important books were stolen or destroyed. The Baghdad University College of Arts, the only graduate humanities library in the country, According to Rebecca Knuth, who has a book on burning books and leveling libraries, the Baghdad University College of Arts was stripped of its furnishings and the entire collection of 175,000 volumes and manuscripts was burned. As a historian, I mean, it breaks my heart to say these things, and especially with regard to the manuscripts, because often manuscripts exist in a single handwritten version. So that's knowledge just gone forever. The Mustansiriya University main library was looted. Mosul Museum was looted and destroyed. Mosul Central University Library lost 30% of its books to vandalism and looting. Basra's Islamic Library was looted. The Central Library of Basra was both looted and destroyed, and 30% of the collection eliminated. 80% of the collection of the Iraqi Academy of Science in Baghdad went missing. That's 58,000 published works and 2,000 discrete manuscripts. The Iraqi population blamed the United States military and the Bush administration for this destruction of the precious cultural heritage of Iraq. It was very clear that U.S. soldiers did not intervene to stop looting and probably were given orders not to do so. Moreover, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld actually came out on public television and in the United States and denied that the looting was going on or that it was significant. He alleged at one point that CNN had a one tape of one man carrying off a vase, and they kept looping it over and over again, and said there wasn't really any looting going on. And he said, how many vases could they have? Well, Mr. Rumsfeld, the Iraqis more or less invented the vase several thousand years ago, so I think by now they probably had quite a few of them. There was a demonstration early on in Basra University in October of 2003. Hundreds of students and faculty demonstrated against the failure of coalition troops in Basra, in the southern Shiite city of Basra, to prevent the assassination of the dean of the College of Engineering. Security was not good already by then. Students at the universities became increasingly politicized, became important voices in calling for a quick end to the U.S. military occupation of the country. When Paul Bremer attempted to impose an American constitution on Iraq, Iraqi students demonstrated against this in line with the condemnation of that plan by Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who insisted that legitimate government could only spring from the will of the Iraqi people. So the Najaf had to instruct Washington in basic Rousseauian and Jeffersonian principle. Students demonstrated at Mustansiriya and other universities in favor of an Iraqi written constitution. By 2004, the interim minister of higher education gave an interview in which he explained that Iraq had at that time 20 universities, 24 technical institutes, a total population of enrolled students of 360,000. There were about 16,000 instructors at these institutions of higher learning, most of them with only a master's degree rather than doctorates. He maintained that at that time, most of the universities were up and running, although they faced severe security problems, and some universities, such as that at Ramadi, could not function at all. Security was the biggest problem facing universities in this era of violence from 2005 to 2008. The Basra University was a site of increased attacks on students by militiamen of the Mahdi Army who insisted on imposing puritanical values on them, breaking up co-educational events, insisting that women veil, and so forth. Mustansiriya University in central Baghdad became a particular site of violence and struggle. Its student union and the presidency of the university itself over time tended to align with the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, one of the major Shiite religious parties, which also emerged as the leading party in parliament. As a result, its professors and students became targets on the part of the anti-government guerrilla movement. In December of 2006, female students from Mustansiri University were kidnapped, raped, and killed by guerrillas. In January, guerrillas used a car bomb and suicide bomber to kill 60 persons at the university, wounding 110 more. In February, another suicide bomber struck in 2007 at the School of Administration and Economy and set off a blast that killed 41 and wounded a similar number of faculty, students, and so forth. In early 2007, Iraq's system of higher education was near to collapsing. Attendance was down. Students were afraid to go to university. Only about half were showing up. And their professors often were simply no longer in the country. Thousands of professionals, professors, teachers, and nurses, et cetera, fled Iraq in this period. The universities have remained, till this time, highly politicized. Student unions often are adjuncts of political parties, and some of the political parties, of course, have militias and paramilitaries, and this affects campus life. There have been problems with students intimidating professors who belong to the opposite political party, or vice versa. There have been difficulties in holding examinations because of student strikes over political issues. And just as I was preparing for this talk, I think an illustrative incident occurred at Mustansiri University. There had been a president of that university, belonged to the, now it's called the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, and was dismissed by the Minister of Education. Another man was put in from a different political orientation. But the old president refused to leave. So there were two presidents of the university and two administrations, and they were struggling with each other. Then the prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, intervened to solve the problem by appointing a third. However, the other two didn't leave, and so now there were three administrations of the university. And of course, students lined up to support each of the three. And earlier this week, there were big demonstrations by students against the prime minister's intervention. Prime Minister al-Maliki has closed Mustansiri University for a week and sent in troops. And now it has decided to ban political organizations on campus. Critics of the prime minister express fears that this move is of a piece with a number of moves that the prime minister has taken, which have the overall effect of casting a chill on freedom of speech and the sorts of rights that are guaranteed in the Iraqi constitution that was ultimately written by the Iraqi parliament. So the whole question of free speech on campus is now at issue. If the prime minister can simply ban political parties from operating, it would be rather as if the president of the United States banned the Young Republicans and the Young Democrats from having chapters on campuses. On the other hand, one has to admit that these political parties and their organizations and the militias that they're attached to have also roiled campus life and made education and higher education very difficult in Iraq. So from the beginning of the U.S. Impact on Iraq until now, the higher education system has suffered enormous deficits. Libraries burned, manuscripts burned, lack of access to the latest research, professors killed, professors chased out of their neighborhoods or even out of the country, students afraid to go to class. The security situation has begun improving in the past year and a half, but it is still not ideal. There are still bombings virtually daily in places like Mosul and in Baghdad. Iraq faces, I think, a long path in getting back on its feet, regaining security, and returning to that golden age of Iraqi higher education when it really was the beacon intellectually of much of the Arab world. There was an old saying in the Arab world that the Egyptians write the books, the Lebanese print the books, and the Iraqis read the books. Booksellers in the Arab world have been complaining in the last few years not so many books being sold because the Iraqis are busy with other things. I think that there is a real danger as the American public concentrates on the question of, you know, when exactly are our troops getting out of there, that the U.S. Public and Congress should not turn their backs on Iraq. The U.S. has had an enormous impact on that country, much of it for ill, and I think a certain responsibility is there for the future to help rebuild higher education when the security situation allows that to happen. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Mori Al-Khalaf, Director and of Cultural and Social Affairs, Saudi Cultural and Educational Mission, Embassy of the Embassy of Washington, D.C. She is former president of linguistics of Princess Noura University, Prince Sultan University, and the Arab Open University in Riyadh, editor-in-chief of a scholarship magazine launched in 1978 by the Saudi Cultural Mission, covering a range of topics of interest to Saudi students and in the United States. Dr. Al-Khalaf.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm truly honored to be among such a distinguished panel. But I admit, when Dr. Anthony first asked me to speak on education and development in Saudi Arabia, I felt a bit challenged. How could I say enough about a country that has developed so much in such a short period of time and say it in minutes? After some thought, I decided to tackle it heads on with facts and figures. First fact, I was born in a mud house lit by a gas lantern and heated with burning wood. The only person present helping my 17-year-old mother bring me into the world was my illiterate grandmother. That was March 1974, and now that everybody knows my age, only 35 years ago. But that was a typical image of three generations of Saudi women, the youngest of which, me, grew up to earn a PhD, to teach thousands of young women at different universities, to represent her country as a foreign diplomat in front of you today. Now again, I can't cover every bit of history, but I'll make two stops. Founded in 1932, perhaps the single leading agent in the transformation of my country was the discovery of oil in 1938. That has led to Saudi Arabia being one of the world's fastest growing economies and the world's largest producer of petroleum liquids, second only to Russia in the production of crude oil. We still have the world's largest reserves of crude oil and definitely the most dynamic economy in the Arab world. Another stop I'll make is in 1970, when Saudi Arabia started with its five-year developmental plans. We are currently in the eighth five-year developmental plan, and that has definitely pushed the wheel of progress forward on many levels: industry, agriculture, mining, banking, and education. I will stop, because this panel is on education and development, with facts that a lot of people don't know about Saudi education. Many people don't know, for example, that Saudi Arabia is one of the leading countries in annual expenditure on education. We spend over 25% of our annual income on investing in education, and that's quite a big budget. Because of that, in about 77 years, we have managed to build over 31,000 schools, 68 technical institutions, 24 universities, the most recent, which just opened a couple of weeks ago, KAUST, or King Abdullah University for Science and Technology, which is definitely going to be a world-renowned center for scientific research. In that period of time, we have managed to train over 400,000 academic staff and provide free tuition, textbooks, and healthcare for over 5 million students. In 77 years, we have managed to raise the literacy rate from 10% to an astounding 82%. Now, Saudi Arabia did not just invest in education inside the country. Early on, as early as King Abdulaziz, who had the foresight to invest in education abroad, Saudi Arabia has been investing in scholarship programs. Today, 42% of our higher education students are educated abroad. The King Abdullah Scholarship Program makes up for about 73% of that 42%. King Abdullah Scholarship Program started in 2005, and yesterday it was mentioned that King Abdullah is a man who makes things happen. I think the King Abdullah Scholarship Program is a true testimony to that on so many levels for Saudi Arabia and for about 30 other countries. If you look at slide 8 on the pages in front of you, I'm sorry if the panel doesn't have a copy. Did you get a copy?
No.
Okay, they'll get you a copy. If you look at slide 8, you'll see the top 10 countries that over 50,000 Saudi students are being sent to. The USA has the lion's share with 22,000 students in 49 states, all but Alaska, if you're wondering. And the other countries other than the 10 you see in front of you include Japan, Poland, Singapore, Italy, Switzerland, Ireland, Taiwan, Ukraine, Scotland, Belgium, Turkey, and I am sure that that will affect our relationship with all of these countries in the future. All of this investment over the years led to a few facts that I found interesting even as a Saudi, so I'll just say a few here and there. Our urbanization rate is 81%, not bad for Bedouins, right? With the world average being only 53%. Today, Saudi Arabia ranks 13th most competitive economy in the world. And Ambassador Al-Jubeir mentioned yesterday that we aim to be one of the top 10 by 2010. And knowing our history, I know we can accomplish that. Our health system is ranked 26th in the world. And if you're wondering, the US is 37th. Our IT sector is the most advanced in the region. And as for humanitarian aid, we are people of faith that love to give to others. And that's why the UN 2009 report ranks Saudi Arabia first in humanitarian aid. Does that mean we don't have any challenges? No. Our country has faced a lot of challenges throughout the years. Perhaps from an educational point of view, our biggest challenge is our high population growth rate. Today being 1.84. About 59% of our population are between 50 and 64, and that in itself poses even more challenges. How do you educate? How do you house? How do you employ? Which brings me to the second challenge. We have a 15% unemployment rate among males only, and there are no statistics on females because we are only 14% of the workforce. Which brings me to the title of this presentation. I truly believe that if you are to discuss education and development in Saudi Arabia, you must view women as the agents of future change. That is why I will make three stops: women in education, women in business, and women in the workforce. Educating women only started in the late 50s in Saudi Arabia, 59 to be exact, with a royal decree. In 1960, the General Presidency for Girls' Education started with 15 schools and 5,000 students. Today, 49% of students in K to 12 grades are girls, 62% in higher education, and last year, Graduates from university were 61% female. So we're even graduating in bigger numbers right now. Women have not been excluded from scholarship programs either. They are 21% of scholarship holders across the world, I mean Saudi scholarship holders, and 25% of scholarship students in the US. If you look at slide 12, you'll see how that number has grown from 2002 to 2009 with a breakdown between male and female. And very recently, the last group of scholarship students, women have been getting more scholarships because their GPAs are higher. And I know that bothered a few guys yesterday when it was said. I'm sorry. It's a fact. Women in business. A lot of people don't know that 40% of family-owned businesses are owned by women. 30% of brokerage accounts, 21% of investments, 10% of real estate in major cities, and if you count towns, villages, and rural areas, it's a higher percentage. Women own 20% of commercial businesses. And because a lot of Saudi women, unfortunately, still don't know how to invest their money, they own more than $45 billion in cash funds just sitting there. Imagine if they knew what to do with it. Back to the workforce. Unfortunately, like I said, we are only 14% in the general workforce. The government has been trying to improve that, and they are 30% if you just count the government sector. And there's a typo on that page. It's 48 in the education sector, because like most other countries, education and medicine have been the two fields attracting employment for women at the onset. So 48% of employees in the education sector are women, and 40% of our Saudi medical staff are females. Now, considering that only a small percentage of women are employed, you might find it amazing to know that of those women, 35% are in managerial positions, directors of departments, deans of colleges, recently a president of a university. The last slides in the presentation are examples of prominent Saudi women, and I'd like to note that these are not the only women. You may have heard their names before or seen their pictures. These are just a few examples, and many more are unknown and unmentioned. Saudi women do not wait for opportunities to be handed to them. They go after them. Thuraya Abed is a leading example. She became director in the United Nations, becoming the first Saudi citizen, not Saudi woman, to hold that position. Saudi women have been named by Time and Forbes among the 100 most influential people in the world, like Lubna Al-Alayan and Nahed Tahir, who became the first female CEO in the region of a bank. Very recent as February 2009, Noor Al-Faiz became the first Saudi female deputy minister. And I'd like to pause here for a second, because that is a government-appointed high-ranking position, which means that much more will come very, very soon. Dr. Salwa Al-Hazza is a world-renowned doctor, and she's a member of 12 medical associations. Muna Abu Sleiman, who spoke in this conference last year, is a TV presenter and was named 2006 as a young global leader. We have Saudi female talented writers and poets. Just the other day, I met a professor who told me that she teaches Naima Nawab's poetry in her class at the university. We don't have cinemas in Saudi Arabia yet, but that didn't stop Haifa Mansour from becoming a film director and winning awards for her movies. Another lady behind the lens of a camera, Suzanne Baaqil, became the first Saudi woman to join Reuters. Saudi women don't drive, a well-publicized fact. But that didn't stop Captain Hanadi Hindi from getting a pilot's license and flying over the skies of Saudi Arabia. Nor did it stop Marwa Al-Aifa from getting behind the wheel of a car and winning international races. So, to answer the question, can Saudi women lead the country into a new era? At the risk of being accused of being biased towards my own gender, I think we are the only single agent that can. Why? Simply because we are the country's largest untapped natural resource. Thank you for this.
Yeah.
that I'd like to introduce our very distinguished commentator, Dr. Al-Sayed, advisor to the Royal Court of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Director, Office of Special Projects for His Royal Highness King Abdullah bin, I have a hard time with these names, Abdulaziz Al-Saud, custodian of two holy places in King of Saudi Arabia.
Thank you.
Dr.
Thank
Al-Sayed.
You very much, Harriet. Thank you. One thing you didn't say, Harriet, that I was privileged to be a friend of the late Senator Fulbright.
Thank you.
And I'll just tell you a couple of things. This is really very sentimental to me because I was brought up to respect and love Senator Fulbright. In 1979, I was teaching at the King Fahd University of Petroleum and Minerals, and the university invited Senator Fulbright to speak. I was his host. That became a wonderful and close friendship and relationship. I saw him in Riyadh after that 3 or 4 times in his visits to the kingdom and accompanied him to see the then Crown Prince, our King Abdullah, and I learned a lot from that association. But since we were talking about education, I also worked under his leadership in the advisory board for the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies here at Georgetown. I was a member of that council. He was the president, and I learned a lot from him. What a great man he was. I've enjoyed listening to the speakers. Each one of them had something wonderful to say. Ted, really, Amadeus is really a great bridge between our two cultures. What you people have done is something wonderful, and you deserve to be congratulated on a job well done. I know what they are doing. I've talked to Ted about it quite a few times. They have really served the purpose of crossing the cultural divide, and they have done a great job, and they deserve to be congratulated on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Cole's heartbreaking account of the damage done to the education in Iraq is indeed very saddening. I want to thank him very much for bringing out to our attention how robust the educational, cultural life in Iraq was. And let's hope that someday Iraq will be able to restore its pivotal position in the Arab world. Let's all pray for that. Dr. Moody, what can I say? I am happy and I'm angry. I'm happy because what you've said brought out the picture of what's happening to women in Saudi Arabia and to the educational system in a manner that brings only, I think, happiness to everyone's heart. But I'm angry because I was supposed to say these things in my speech 2 hours from now. So I don't have much of the material that I should have to work with. But let me just point out something that, I had actually the honor and pleasure to attend the opening ceremonies of KAUS, the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. That university is actually
again, that was mentioned before, but I just want to say that that university, since we're talking about building bridges, is going to be the big bridge between our country and the other countries in the world, particularly the United States. I say this as I read in front of me here the International Advisory Board of this university. Just, I'll read some names here. There's Dr. Frank Press. He's the president of the advisory board. He was, I think, the honorary chairman of the American National Scientific Board, I think, if that's what it is. I'm reading from Arabic here. Then there's Dr. Samuel Bodman, who was your energy, I think, secretary at some point. Dr. Paul C. Wucho from the University of Houston and president of University of Houston for Sciences. Professor John Dowling from Harvard. Please. Professor Richard Friend from Cambridge. Professor Hermann Wolfgang from Munich, and the rest goes on. So already this university is serving to put Saudi Arabia in good company. I've enjoyed the company of everyone here. I've enjoyed your company. Thank you very much. I think the session is over, as I'm being told. But I'll leave that to Harry.
We do. Okay. We have some wonderful questions here, and I'm just going to try to give them all justice. The first one is, the progress achieved by Saudi Arabia in women education is impressive, but what justifies continued inequality and barriers to women's progress in Saudi Arabia that are holding the whole country back? Examples are travel restrictions, driving, voting, and political presence.
Okay, nothing justifies it. I mean, that's a simple answer. But the truth is, the fact that the government has appointed a female president to be a university and a deputy minister, that's much more important than a driver's license. Not that a driver's license is not important. I would like a driver's license in Saudi Arabia. But what I'm trying to say is that the government has given faith to women on those levels, which are higher. And the rest, I think, is a matter of social dynamics. And those of you who have studied sociology know that it takes a lot longer to develop on the social level than it does on a political or financial level. So hopefully that will change in the future, and there is no justification.
Thank you. And this is for Dr. Cole. How can the mainly Sunni-dominated nations assist in securing and restructuring the Iraqi university system?
Well, I really don't think that at the level of higher education it's relevant whether people are Sunni or Shia or Christian or Jewish or what they are. Education, higher education, is a matter of reasoning and analysis. Baghdad was famed in the medieval period after it was founded by the Abbasids for establishing a center of wisdom in which the great Greek works and Sanskrit works were translated into Arabic. And there are still today some essays of Aristotle that only exist in Arabic translation. This was a multicultural enterprise. Greek and Syriac Christians and Muslim Arabs were involved, Sunnis and Shiites and so forth. And, you know, if Baghdad is going to ever get back to its glory days, it's going to have to be on that basis of a multicultural enterprise.
Thank you. The next one is also for Dr. Cole. What would be the best route for a foundation to possibly contribute to the rebuilding of the schools in Iraq? Should we focus on elementary levels? If we were to focus on the university, is it better to bring these scholars out of Iraq and hope that they return once they complete their studies?
Well, establishing a foundation to help Iraqi higher education would be an enormous task, but I actually think that there are plenty of resources already in existence in the form of U.S. government programs. There's potentially a lot of money sloshing around for these things, and I think it's just a matter of making sure that it's well used. I will say that despite the lowering of civilian death rates in Iraq in the past year and a half, the security situation is still not good, and the refugees are not returning. And apparently, one of the reasons I did my research in Jordan was to find out why. And their neighborhoods have been ethnically cleansed, so they feel there's nothing to go back to. They have lost their property. Their neighborhoods no longer have their old composition. And as long as that kind of insecurity is there, and the refugees aren't able to come back. A lot of the refugees are actually university professors or high school teachers or professionals of other sorts. There's a real problem of just sheer expertise. With regard to bringing Iraqi scholars to the U.S. And giving them perches until things can resolve themselves, I think that's a wonderful idea. And I'm not so worried about, you know, a brain drain from Iraq in the medium to long term, because I think the country will eventually get back on its feet, and it has enormous resources. In fact, some of us may end up working there as our unemployment rate rises. But in the short term, we need to make arrangements for people to have a perch at U.S. universities, certainly.
Thank you. I will try one last question, too. That is, how has Saudi Arabia demonstrated tolerance and development in its interfaith dialogue and educational initiatives? This refers to social, religious, and cultural tolerance. It was for either one of you.
Let me see the question. Religious style.
I'll try to probably say what the concept of intercultural and interfaith dialogue, how it started. Most people think it started with the international forums, but really it started in Saudi society. In other words, it started as an idea to bring the various segments of Saudi society together around tables to talk, and to talk freely. Issues as thorny, as difficult as these have been brought up, have been discussed. And I think we have eventually came to some of the, some things that happened as a result of this were truly, truly wonderful. Now, my understanding is that they are asking about and educational initiatives, to sociological and cultural tolerance. Tolerance is a concept that is actually you know, new to most of our societies in the Middle East, as you know. You have been practicing this at much earlier periods than we have, at least in recent times. Now, and if you go back to Arab history, for example, if you go to Bayt al-Hikma in Baghdad, it was a place where scientists from all religions, all cultures, sat together and worked together. But, of course, times have changed. Now we're trying to bring back that concept. I mean, for example, the idea of Khoust University is one idea that hopefully will bring people together from various cultures in Saudi Arabia to work with our students, with our teachers. And I think we in Saudi Arabia notice, for example, people, you may not notice this here, but we notice, for example, in our media,
there is a much more robust media coverage now and discussion of the various issues, including women issues, including education, including all of the other aspects. It has actually opened venues that maybe Ted remembers that weren't even being discussed in the past. Today, these things are being discussed openly, robustly, and in an upfront way. So I think the interfaith dialogue, which started as the national Saudi dialogue, that's the beginning of it, has in fact contributed a great deal to the progress that our society is witnessing today. Now, mind you, I am a student of political sociology. My colleague and sister, Dr. Khalaf, referred to this. Change does not happen overnight, and change should not really happen because someone wants you to change. You change because you are convinced that that's the right path for you. We are convinced that we need to change, but we will do it in ways that will not be disruptive to our society. We'll do it in ways that will bring the maximum benefit to our society. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think you'll agree that has been an extraordinarily informative and interesting panel, and let's thank Mrs. Fulbright and all of the panelists for their input.